Okay. Dr. Resnick is an internationally known scholar and speaker on Hinduism and everything about India. Known him a long time. He's a really great lecturer. He's also a Sanskrit scholar. He's translated the Bhagavata Purana, which you might remember from the beginning of the semester. So he's very well received wherever he goes. So without further ado, Dr. Resnick.
Okay. So, you talked about the Mahabharata, didn't you?
Yes.
So I'll just begin with the Mahabharata. You'll see why. Mahabharata, Maha means great. It's in Latin, magna, words like magnificent, magnified. So great Bharata. Bharata is the name of India in most Indian languages. If you ever see an Indian postage stamp, in the Roman alphabet it says India, and in Devanagari it says Bharata. In the Sanskrit in the alphabet it says Bharata. So, and today's topic is like India today, right?
Yeah.
So,
a religion in modern.
Religion in modern India. Basically, there's this tremendous conflict in modern India. There's this tremendous conflict between what they perceive as a glorious past and the seduction of modernity. So I want to talk about that, this conflict, because this tension between the past as people perceive it, and to some extent a nostalgic, romanticized version of the past, and the reality of what's going on today in India, that tension really explains a lot of what's going on. So also, it just so happened that I'm going to be speaking in Tampa on Thursday, and a friend there who runs a spiritual community, which I don't belong to, but runs a spiritual community, sent me this article that appeared in the New York Times, and also it's appearing elsewhere, about a very famous Indian Swami, spiritual leader called Ramdev. Ramdev. So how many of you from India have heard of Ramdev? Swami Ramdev? Well, that proves that he's very famous. So, anyway, he is very famous, but I guess. And so he's got this new political agenda, and it's amazing. And I printed this article. I want to read you some quotes because it's really fantastic, like what he's saying and how it plays into all this. So I hope that I'll be able to keep you awake for most of the time. And if you fall asleep, don't snore. So, regarding the Mahabharata, Mahabharata is a historical work. There are different genres of sacred Indian literature. Of course, Mahabharata is called Itihasa, which literally in Sanskrit means thus it was. So this is the genre of historical literature, a sacred history. Now, the basic idea is that according to the tradition, within the Hindu tradition or Vedic tradition, 5,000 years ago, there was a change of, you could say, planetary season. And by the way, El Nino started about 5,000 years ago. And there was a climactic change on Earth. Coming to take me away. So, there was a climactic change about 5,000 years ago on Earth. And also, there were significant political upheavals and changes in, for example, Mesopotamia and, they say, in ancient Egypt. So, it's interesting because 5,000 years ago, it's kind of a date. And in which there's major climate changes on Earth, there's major political upheavals and so on. And according to ancient India, at that time, 5,000 years ago, one great age ended. One great age ended and another began. And it's also, you've seen the movie Avatar, many of you have heard about it. So Krishna, according to the tradition, Krishna, the single most popular figure in Indian religion, appeared about 5,000 years ago, and it said the very day that Krishna left this world, the very day that Krishna went back to the spiritual realm, a new age began, the age of Kali, which is a nasty age. The age of quarrel. This idea that there are different planetary ages, and that there's a golden age, then silver, bronze, and finally the iron age of Kali, is an idea that was popular not only in India, but actually throughout the ancient world. If you look at Hesiod, the ancient Greek writer who, after Homer, was the most important ancient Greek writer, he talks about these four ages. And he also, he metalizes them. There's the Golden Age, and the Silver Age and the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. So this was, and that's a whole other topic, like all the striking similarities between ancient India and the ancient Greco-Roman civilization, or of course more Greece once you get earlier, but so that's a whole other topic. And it is, in a sense, an Indo-European civilization. Did you talk about that, the Indo-European thing? Okay. But I won't get into that now.
We talked about Indo-European languages.
Okay. So anyway, there was, according to almost every scholar, an ancient Indo-European civilization. If you look at Roman religion, it's very much like, it's sort of like Mediterranean Hinduism, if you look at Roman religion. But in any case, the picture that Indians have of their past, again, Mahabharata, great Bharata, the picture is a very glorious one. It's a time when India is really exercises political, cultural, and you could say spiritual dominion in the world. That India is very much, in that view, sort of the center of the world. Now we do know, for example, we do know that India was, in a sense, the richest country in the world. It was fabulously wealthy before a series of foreign invasions and sort of brutal colonial regimes changed that landscape. But in fact, it's said that I saw a statistic that up to about 200 years ago, a very large percentage of the world's wealth was in India. You know, something like 20% of all the wealth in the world was in India up till maybe 250 years ago. So you have this picture of this glorious past when India had this... for example, in Greek, in ancient Greek, the word for foreigner is also the word for barbarian. And the Greeks, in ancient Greece, they really had this very strong sense of a cultural superiority. Of a cultural superiority. And even Paul of Tarsus, if you know the New Testament, he was traveling around the Mediterranean preaching. When he got to Athens, it was like, oh my God, I'm in Athens. Because it really had that image. And Paul even kind of changes his preaching tone a little bit. He tries to sound more philosophical because he's in Athens. And so just as in ancient Greece, there was this real sense of cultural superiority, which in a sense they had. If you look at their architecture, their philosophy, their literature and so on, really there was a real cultural buzz there. And so in the same way, India had this very strong sense of being a spiritual cultural center at a time when in other parts of the world there were, let's say, like religious, well, that's sort of anachronistic, religious wars sort of more in the Middle East and a little later. But in any case, they have this yoga tradition, they're deeply into meditation, self-realization, they have a philosophical tradition. It's interesting because if you look at, say, philosophical traditions, if you look at regions of the world that created their own or developed their own independent, comprehensive, historically sustained philosophical traditions, it's only two places in the world. And they're both within Indo-European civilizations, Europe and India. If you look at China, for example, China got into what you might call systematic philosophy when Buddhism came there from India. Buddhism came in this cultural package which included systematic philosophy. And Japan was like the Wild West back then, so you know they went to China to get their culture. So if you look at the Islamic civilization, which reached great cultural heights, let's say about 1,000 years ago, they very famously preserved Aristotle. They were the preservers of Greek philosophy. And so if you look at the Islamic culture at its height, at its cultural height, when it was really... When the Western Europeans were the terrorists, and everything was kind of reversed, they were doing Greek philosophy. So in India also has this very powerful philosophical tradition, which is independent, which simply comes from India, it's indigenous. And so you have Ram Raja, you probably talked about that.
No.
Oh, you didn't? Oh. One of the great avatars in Indian culture, in Hinduism or Vedic culture, is of course Rama. And Raja, the word Raja in Sanskrit means kingdom. You know, like English royal, if you know Spanish, reino, and so on and so forth. So Ram Raja, the kingdom of Ram. And that's from another historical epic, the Ramayana, the idea that this was the ideal kingdom. So whereas in America, we have this revolutionary experience where founding fathers, Jefferson, Madison, all these people kind of conceived of this democratic state. So in India, people look back with tremendous, very profound historical nostalgia to these ideal civilizations, these ideal kingdoms that are described in their great historical epics. So that's one thing that's always there. There's always this very powerful cultural force in India of looking back to this great, glorious past when India really achieved a certain cultural, spiritual level which to this day has not been equaled. And it's not merely mythology. I mean, I don't want to discount all of it as mythology because, for example, there's a... I'm running out of room here. There's a gentleman named Megasthenes who was a Greek ambassador. Oh, thanks. Leave me your card. So there's a gentleman named Megasthenes, Mr. Megasthenes, about 2,300 years ago. That's about 300. What are we supposed to say? BCE. So Megasthenes, approximately 2,300 years ago, was a Greek ambassador to India. There was an empire in India called the Mauryan Empire, which was centered in what is now Patna, the capital of the state of Bihar. The Mauryan Empire was a great empire in India, and he was an ambassador. And he wrote a book called Indica, which means about India. And this book was a real sensation. It was a bestseller in the ancient world, Indica. And he describes an extraordinarily, I don't know what you'd call it, advanced civilization. For example, Megasthenes says, among other things, that unlike other civilizations in the world, like the one he came from, there's no slavery in India. He says also that in India they don't have starving artists, because if anyone has any ability, let's say in art or poetry, any of the arts, the government subsidizes that person. There are animal rights. There are government ministers that travel around the country making sure that no human being or other creature, no human being, that no living thing is abused. That every living creature is treated respectfully. There are animal hospitals. That if a foreigner dies in India, the government immediately steps in, protects all the assets of that person, notifies the family, and so foreigners are very, very well treated. There's, of course, we know from the Mahabharata, there's our next contestant. He'll be trying to win some prizes here. So, Megasthenes also says that, not Megasthenes, but from the Mahabharata, there's political freedom. There's freedoms that we think were invented at the time of the Bill of Rights. For example, in the Mahabharata, you can go out into the town square in the capital of India, Hastinapur, and criticize the government. You can criticize the king. And there's never a hint of any reprisals, any repercussions. You can do that. There's not the slightest hint that that's illegal or something bad is going to happen to you. People have freedom of speech. So that's the picture we get. Another interesting and, you could say, somewhat precocious cultural item here is that in ancient India, there was freedom of religion. In the oldest, usually the dating of Indian sacred texts is done by linguistic analysis, just like we know that Chaucer, the English in Chaucer is older than Shakespeare. Shakespeare is older than your computer handbook. So in that way, by linguistic analysis, we know that, let's say, the oldest layer, the oldest stratum of the sacred literature is called the... Think ahead. Okay. Rig Veda, which you probably talked about. Anyway, in the Rig Veda, there's a famous statement that there's one God, there's one truth, but different sages, different thinkers invoke that truth or talk about it in different ways. So there's this, from the earliest times, there's a very cosmopolitan view of world religions. That there's one God, there's one truth that is present in many different traditions, called in different ways, and so on. So it's that civilization, a place where people were happy, people were peaceful. Even Marco Polo, kind of, it kind of blew his mind how rich the people of India were. that even ordinary people would just, you know, wear gold all over their bodies and so on. So here you have a civilization which is very wealthy, which is culturally sophisticated, and has what we would call human rights beyond what we have, in the sense that there's also, let's say, animal rights. There's all kinds of things going on. They produce great literature. They produce some of the most profound spiritual traditions in history, the yoga tradition, and so on. And so people look back to this. And at the same time, so I'm going to talk about Ramdev, because I want to give an example of someone who in India is very popular. The New York Times talks about his empire in India. He has his yoga empire. And when he does these TV shows, it's basically yoga for health. And if you can YouTube him, by the way. He's YouTubeable. Swami Ramdev, and you'll find that he has little clips. There's like yoga for back problems, yoga for knee problems, yoga for pregnant women, yoga for this. I mean, anything you've got, he's got a yoga thing on YouTube for it. And so he's got this empire. He owns hospitals and so on. Now he's getting into politics. And so I want to talk a little bit about Ramdev. And to understand Ramdev, one other thing I should mention. In India, they not only have this very strong sense of a glorious past. I'm going to keep track of the time so you get your break. I had a professor at Harvard who, we'd always have these 2-hour classes in Sanskrit and so on. And like every class, after about the first hour, he'd say, "Should we take a break?" And before anyone could answer, he said, "Oh, well, I guess not. We'll keep going." Anyway.
Who was this?
Witzel. So, India not only has a sense of a glorious past, there's also a very strong sense that they didn't voluntarily just give up this past. It was violently, murderously stolen from them. And this is something I talked about actually when I gave this class, that you can understand Indian history in a dialectical sense, which, in any case, about 1,000 years ago, there was a Muslim invasion of India. And the Muslim world, of course, was quite broad back in those days. Some parts of it were very, very sophisticated culturally, very liberal. Some parts of it were barbarous. I mean, if you look at the world today, if you look at all, let's say, the Christian world today, some places are very liberal and sophisticated, some places are really pretty horrible. So unfortunately, the particular Muslims that invaded India were not the liberal, culturally sophisticated, enlightened guys. It was rather coming out of Middle Asia. It was sort of like the most violent tribal part of that realm coming from Central Asia. And in fact, the Muhammad of Ghazni, who's sort of like, I mean, these figures, to understand the Hindu mentality, some of these figures are kind of, people see them in India the way you might see Hitler or Stalin or people like that. They're really seen as monsters. And, for example, Al-Biruni, who was the secretary to Muhammad of Ghazni, bragged that they had successfully, you know, practically destroyed Indian culture. He thought this was like a really cool thing. That they had destroyed Indian culture, that they had impoverished, that they had broken the prosperity of the country, they had driven the culture away, and so on and so forth. And so these were extremely violent, extremely greedy raids. At first, just plundering raids, and eventually they established a government in Delhi. They destroyed sacred places. They destroyed some of the architectural wonders of the world. So it was, I think, objectively pretty awful. Then you got the Mughal. There were you know, two stages of this Muslim domination, political domination, and then the Mughal Empire. And I don't mean to say it was all bad. I mean, there were all kinds of cultural contributions. There were all kinds of Muslims in India who were actually, you could say, legitimate saints. Sufi saints, people who were in their own way enlightened, people who were liberal. You have Akbar, the great emperor Akbar, who is remembered to this day in India, one of the Mughal emperors, as one of the most enlightened rulers in Indian history. So it's not all a dark picture. but there was a lot of darkness. And then, of course, the Mughal Empire passed the baton involuntarily to the British. And the British took over, and they did what they did best at the time, you know, plunder and sack and so on and so forth. So you have to understand these two things, because India has only become free from colonial rule, I mean, very recently. So on the one hand, you have this very strong sense of a glorious past that once we really ruled the world. And if you look at all the places in the world that once were kind of on top, they sort of don't lose it. It embeds itself in the collective consciousness. You look at Greece. To this day, you go to Greece, and they have this real sense that, hey, everyone else in the Western world just got it from us. So there's this real strong sense of we're still kind of it. You see it in Italy. You see it in Italy because they have the Roman Empire. You see it in England. England once had their empire. There's still a sense in England that we're special because we ruled the world. And India has this very strong sense, not only of just that we were the most spiritual or cultural, or, I mean, I'm sorry, not just we were the most politically, we were politically dominant, but that actually we have given the world the greatest spirituality, the deepest culture. You see this very clearly in Vivekananda. You know, when Vivekananda came to the World Congress of Religion in Chicago around 1899, and kind of his own version of Hindu one-upsmanship. And the idea that, look, you guys have all these sectarian, warring, fanatical religions, but in India we actually have this broad-minded, ancient, profound tradition that was beyond all that. We didn't get into all this sectarian violence and my God can, you know, beat up your God and all this stuff. So if you consider these two factors in the Indian psyche, and it's very deep in the Hindu collective consciousness, that we had this most glorious past, and it was stolen from us. It was brutally, murderously stolen from us. And now that we're independent, we have to get back to our real culture. And not just become, let's say, a consumer colony. And so you take those two things, a glorious past was stolen from us, we were brutalized, you know, the crown jewels of England came from India, stolen from deities. There's a great, I forget the name of it, but one of the 19th century great English novels, I forget the name, where this guy steals these jewels from a deity in India, this English officer, and then his life kind of gets cursed until the jewels are given back. So you have those two things. Imagine those two factors. Then you add a third factor, which is that now the West is totally dominant and Indians are sort of, you know, as quick as they can, grabbing Western things. So you go to a good Indian university today, they have some very good universities, try to find someone that's not wearing blue jeans and a t-shirt. So if you look at Western music, if you look at the MTV, food, fast food, everything. And so some people in India, just as there were different groups in India that resisted the British attempt to assimilate India into Western culture, so now they're free, but some people want to go back to quote-unquote our own culture. And so that's really this. And whereas other people in India, obviously, most people, they want Western things, and yet there's all these currents and counter-currents. So I want to give an example of Ramdev, because he's an amazing case in point. I mean, I read this article, I was thinking, oh my God. So I'll read you some of this stuff, and you'll see what I mean, I hope. So this is an article from the New York Times, and it's from 2 days ago. This is 2 days ago. So this is hot off the press. So they talk about this article, tens of millions of people watching his television programs. And now his thing is, as he's teaching this yoga, this sort of medical yoga, He says, we clean up our bodies, he cried, then we will clean up our democracy. So now he's just like leaping into the political arena of India. And he's got this agenda. So he's a Swami. He wears saffron robes. I guess you couldn't print the, didn't get the picture. But anyway, he's this sort of quintessential Hindu Swami. He's sort of in his 50s, good-looking guy, sort of a handsome guy. He's got this big black beard, and what the New York Times calls his the chiclet white dazzle of his smile, undimmed by the wild bush of his beard. His own 50-ish body, lithe and supple as it whipped through the poses, yoga poses. So, and he's like this really, got this really cool appearance, you know, he's, guy's totally in shape, yoga, big black beard, great smile, handsome guy, and actually sort of walks the talk. He's not one of these yogis that ends up having, you know, like dozens of mistresses. He really follows the principles. And so now he's jumping into the political arena. There really are comparisons with, let's say, the Christian right in America. The Christian right, like, we've got to get back to our original culture. We've got to get back to the real original America. We've got to get back to the values that made this country great. So this combination of sort of, you know, you'd call it literally like uber nationalism, you know, this real heavy nationalism combined with, let's say, religious leadership, religious leaders really getting into nationalism, which is so prominent in American politics or has been. But this is very similar. Obviously, this is in India. This is Hinduism. It's a completely different cultural context, but a lot of things are the same, a lot of the dynamics. So he says, what the people need is honest, brave, and responsible leadership. Anyway, the New York Times, he said, in an interview at the sprawling campus of his rapidly expanding yoga, natural foods, and medicine empire in northern India. So the guy is, you know, he's doing very well. The country's political system is riddled with corruption, riven by the deep divisions of religion and caste. He said, tapping into the ancient Indian wisdom that gave birth to yoga and the holy texts like the Vedas and Upanishads. So, I mean, there's something, some of that is true. If you look at Indian history, you could argue that although, you know, politics is always kind of a nasty arena, but that there was sort of a high ground. There were real moral principles. In fact, the whole Mahabharata was a fight to reestablish ethical principles in government. So, but I want to get now to some other stuff. He says, he wants a total revolution. Multinational corporations have no place in India. Now, I love this one. This is one of my favorite lines from this article. Be Indian, he exhorted his followers on a recent morning. Speak Indian languages. Wear Indian clothes. Drink Indian drinks. All things foreign, he argues, like Coca-Cola and hamburgers, pollute the quote-unquote Indian spirit and weaken it. The World Health Organization is a favorite target. A big conspiracy cooked up by American pharmaceutical companies. So, what's interesting is that if you look at the book, the one book which is considered the... what time should I stop? 9:20 or...
Yeah, that's
good. So, hang in there. There's light at the end of the tunnel. Just 16 more minutes to get a break. So, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, there's an organization called the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, which means the sort of like the world Hindu organization. And it's not the official leader of Hinduism, but it is a prominent organization. They voted a couple years ago that the official book of Hinduism, or the most prominent book of Hinduism, was Bhagavad Gita. And you could read any textbook about Hinduism, they'll say the Bhagavad Gita is like the book. It's the single most important book. The Bhagavad Gita, the very first lesson is that we are not our bodies. The body is just a temporary covering of the soul. And so our real identity is spiritual, not material. And it is precisely, let's say, national designations, like I'm Indian, I'm American, I'm Uruguayan, probably relates to most of you. I mean, all these different designations are just refer to the body. And all the great Indian traditions, if you look at Buddha, the Buddhism, the second sermon of Buddha on the non-existence of the self, which, by the way, he never said, which is an interesting aspect of Buddhism, the official sermon on the non-existence of the self, Buddha never said there's no self. But in any case, the whole point is the body is just a covering. It's not really us. So in the name of the Vedas, in the name of the Upanishads, which teach over and over and over again, Bhagavad Gita, that you are not your body, you are an eternal spiritual being. All the bodily designations called upadis. So there's a Sanskrit upadi, which means, for example, I'm male, I'm female. Well, no, actually I'm not androgynous. I'm male. But someone may think, I'm male, I'm female, or I'm so many years old, this race, this size or shape, or I'm American or Indian. Those are just names that are given to the body. We are eternal souls. So in the name of the Vedas, to say you are Indian, the Indian spirit. And then what about the fact that Ram Dev himself has an expanding media empire? I mean, where do you... I mean, he uses all kinds of video equipment. He owns an island in Scotland because some rich Indian in Scotland, you know, bought him an island. And so he himself is using all these Western technologies and media, so you can use Western video equipment, you just can't drink Coca-Cola. I guess there's some distinction there. And I don't just mean to ridicule Ramdev, because I'm sure in many ways he's sincere and he's trying to do good things. And so I'm not trying to put him down. But what is Indian? If you take, let's say, Indian ethnicity, what about the fact that a chunk of it, I wouldn't say most of it, but a chunk of it comes from the Islamic world? For example, one of the things that Ramdev says is speak Indian languages, like don't speak English, although he does speak English. If you look at Hindi, which is the national language of India, just as English is a combination of, let's say, an original Germanic language, and then all these Latin words, which came with the Norman invasion. So that almost for everything you want to say in English, you can use a Germanic word, a Roman word, a Latin word. For example, you can say that God, to use a very German term, is all good, right? Which in German would be all gut, all good. Or you can say God is omnibenevolent, which is sort of like pure Latin. Or omniscient, all knowing is German, obviously, right? All knowing. They still pronounce the K in Germany. So God is all-knowing, or which is German, or omniscient, which is Latin, omniscient. In the same way, Hindi, in a very similar way, Hindi is a combination of Sanskritic words and Arabic words. So, for example, in Hindi, if you want to say boy, you can say Kumar, Kumara, which is pure Sanskrit, or you can say Larka, which is, you know, coming from the Arabic word. So, and what's interesting is that, you know, Hindus, like just an ordinary Indian conversation, they often use the Arabic word. So if he's saying speak Indian languages, and there's something very interesting about this, because if you say don't speak English, because English, of course, really is in a sense the language of India at a certain educational, socioeconomic level. In fact, now in India, you know, so many schools are just an English medium. English, ironically, English is an Indo-European language. English and Sanskrit are actually very close in many ways. For example, in Sanskrit, if you wanted to call your mother, you would say mater, father Peter, like paternal, or sister Swasser, daughter Duiter. And we can go on and on. There's like hundreds and thousands of similar words. And even the structure of the language, we go on and on with grammar, historical linguistics, but whereas Arabic is, of course, a Semitic language. And I'm not trying to say one is better than the other. I'm just trying to neutrally explain certain things about linguistic history. So Ramdev is saying only speak Indian languages, even though in, let's say, all the North Indian languages, you have this huge influx of Arabic words, which actually come from another language family, and English is much more Sanskritic than Arabic, just because it's in the same language family. And yet he's saying, don't speak English, only speak Indian languages. So, or one of the most popular Indian preparations, sweets, is called halwa. You all know that, right? It's, you know, it's like you make with farina and sugar and butter. I mean, it's very, very, everyone eats it. It's like the universal Indian sweet. And halva is an Arabic word. And it's a Mediterranean preparation. So when you get to this thing like, don't drink Coca-Cola, but eat halwa. Or, for example, if you see the way, in India, the way they cook vegetables. Some of the most popular things to use, what they call sabjis, or in Indian vegetable preparations, is potato, tomato, chili. It's very common, none of which existed in India a few centuries ago. You know, they came over with the colony. Apparently they're indigenous to South America. So when you get into the thing, whether it's language or whether it's cooking or dress or we go into all kinds of issues, and Ramdev is saying we have to get back to Indianness, in some ways it just comes out being a mundane nationalism as opposed to a return to a glorious spiritual past which was based on a sort of revealed culture that came from God. And yet, in people like Ramdev, often these two things mix. It's like you have this glorious past, which was, you could say, Vedic, pre-Hindu, Vedic, and then whatever is Hindu is Vedic, and whatever is Indian is Hindu. And so you get this sort of ahistorical belief that this ethnicity in India is somehow part of a sacred tradition that came down from this glorious revealed ancient civilization. So, again, I don't want to bash Ramdev but similar criticisms are made, for example, against the Christian right in America, and I'm not trying to be anti-Christian, but there are certain ways of remembering the way of how America used to be and our real history. For example, I was just in speaking at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, and I happened to read this local newspaper called the Seaville, you know, Charlottesville. And in this case, it was an article, sort of article from political left, criticizing the fact that in Virginia, even in that part of Virginia, because Charlottesville is kind of a liberal place, but even there, that so many of the local politicians kind of brought God into their political decisions. And this article was criticizing that. And actually that was a bad example. Anyway, sorry, I just had a glitch. What I did want to say is that a lot of times on the Christian right, when they talk about the founding fathers and what their beliefs were, I mean, they were definitely God conscious, but some of them were explicitly not so Christian. I mean, they were God conscious, certainly, but for example, Thomas Jefferson was criticized for being a deist, was criticized for getting too much into other intellectual ideas of God coming from France and Europe and not just being a straightforward Christian. So just as sometimes on the right you have this memory of what America used to be, that America was just this pure Christian nation, we got to get back to that. So you have similarly this nostalgia for what used to be this pure Hindu nation, and yet some of it is very ahistorical. I'm trying to make this point clear, but
I love it. It's a good deconstruction of Swami Ramdev.
Any questions on these points? Otherwise, we'll take a break very soon. Beat the clock. No questions. Yes.
If people in society are not capable of receiving actual, spiritual personality who's trying to actually imbibe spiritual culture into a society, then there has to be a reaction for the, in India you're talking about, you have this whole secularism, this humanitarianism that's coming from the West.
Not only from the West.
Okay.
Actually, if you look at Buddhism, I mean, in a sense, that's something I wanted to mention, that yeah, in the past, let me put it this way. There's always been, I think, in Indian history, a certain tension between two very strong cultural tendencies in India. One is that in India, there was this, I think, extraordinary understanding of the oneness of all things. And I'm not here talking about a monistic doctrine where you don't really exist as a free individual soul. We all merge into this sort of corporate radiance, this you know, spiritual blob, this oneness. I'm not talking about monism, but that there's a oneness of all life. That the spirit within the body of any living thing is really one with the spirit in any other living thing, which is one with the spirit of God. And by the way, that idea of this oneness was used explicitly and consciously used in the Avatar movie. How many of you saw the Avatar movie? So, right? I mean, that's how the good guys win at the end. Because the idea being that all life is connected, this comes right. In fact, the producer of the movie, John Landau, who's a good friend of mine, admitted very explicitly that's where he got the idea. That he got a lot of these ideas from there. That's why, you know, the Avatar was blue, that comes from Krishna and so on. So anyway, the idea that all life is interconnected, and that not only connected to each other, but connected to each other through the deity. And that's what happens at the end of the Avatar movie. That somehow or other the, you know, the God or the One or the deity or the spirit or whatever you want to call it, kind of mobilizes all the different life forms because they're all connected. Because all life is connected. Therefore, the deity can mobilize all these different life forms, humans, animals, or whatever those people were. And so this, of course, comes right from ancient India. It comes right from ancient India. So you have this oneness, the great Vedanta revelation of the oneness of all things, the oneness of life, our oneness with God. Therefore, respect for all creatures. Animal hospitals, thousands of years ago in India. And yet, India has also been a country which really got into hierarchy. So you have this caste system. And before Western people become too sanctimonious about the Indian caste system, Europe had a wonderful, oppressive, hereditary caste system for a very long time, which only ended with the Industrial Revolution. And the only reason India still had a hereditary caste system longer than the West is because the Industrial Revolution came later. So, anyway. And by the way, we still have nationalism, which is a hereditary caste system. Because in most countries of the world, you are a German or this or that, because you were born there. I mean, obviously there's immigration, and nowadays there's a lot of immigration, but traditionally, and to a great extent, in most countries, you're a citizen because you were born there. And that's a hereditary caste system, right? You have more rights because you were born in the right place. But in any case, so India did have this. In fact, the East, even if you look at Alexander, when Alexander conquered the Persian Empire, which is basically what he did, the East, there was always this divide, like what Kipling said, East is East and West is West, and never the twain shall meet. In the East was always more hierarchical, and the West was more egalitarian. And this goes back even to the earliest contacts between these two cultures. So in India, you have this hierarchy. But the hierarchy is based on the body. In other words, like the caste system, if your body is a Brahmin, because no one is a Brahmin, and there are many statements actually in the ancient texts that, you know, no one is a Brahmin, no one is really, it's just the body. You're born in a Brahmin's body, or a Kshatriya body, or a Vaishya Shudra body, or a male body, or a female body. So all these social hierarchies, are based on the body. But the spiritual teaching is, you're not the body. You're really a spiritual being. And as spiritual beings, we're all equal. So, at times in Indian history, when people were more materialistic and identified more with their bodies, the hierarchy became more oppressive. Because, no, I'm really above you and you're really below me. And at times when there was spiritual reform and the spirituality became more prominent, the hierarchy was greatly moderated by and balanced by a general culture that we're all equal. So you can look at times in Indian history, and Ramdev talks about this, by the way, when he talks about the oppressive still caste designations. There was a time around 2,500 years ago in India, and earlier, didn't just start like, okay, it's 2,500 years ago, let's get this thing going now. But around that time in history, the caste system had become oppressive because it was an age of materialism. And this oppression was evident toward human beings and kind of like, you know, really putting them down, the people in the lower caste. And it was also evident in attitudes toward animals. Like they sort of had a huge Vedic kosher meat industry going on back then, where they would, you know, just kill lots of animals and just do some formality and offering, and then eat it. So Buddhism, you had all these movements rebelling against that. The Buddhist movement, the Jainist movement, and movements within Vedic culture, such as within the, you know, Upanishadic people and so on. People that wrote books, the sacred texts called the Aranyakas. So basically, I mean, every civilization has its boom-bust cycles. In every side of the history of any religion, they have their boom-bust cycles. I mean, so in India, when the hierarchy became oppressive, you have this pushing back and these reactions against it. And some of the most prominent reactions were Buddhism, Jainism, and certain movements within the Vedic culture also, in the production of new literatures like the Aranyakas, the Upanishads, and so on. And so, because these movements sort of, you know, emphasize the spirituality, we're all one, and nonviolence, like stop oppressing animals. Now, interestingly, this thing about animals, the thing about linking the oppression of human beings and the oppression of animals was one of the most prominent features of the French Revolution. The French Revolution had a huge animal rights thing in it, and I'll explain why. Because, as we know, to produce meat, producing meat, in addition to basically destroying, you know, the water supply of the world, it's a huge water problem, and it takes much more land. It's extremely uneconomical. I have to say this. I just saw a trash can out there. I want to report to you about the trash can I saw. It was a recycle thing out there on the campus. It said, Gators Care. It's like, recycle here. And I was thinking, right next to this recycle thing was the, what do they call it? The, where everybody eats over there? That little round building, low round building. Anyway.
Food court.
What?
Food court?
Yeah, food court. The food court, and as we know, the food court, by serving meat, and these are just facts, this is not preaching, this is just facts, is doing 1,000 times more harm to the environment than the recycle barrel is doing good. And this is according to United Nations statistics and so on and so forth. But in any case, because it takes so much more land to produce meat, it takes a, you know, 10 times, it takes so much more land, so back in Europe, the time of the French Revolution, rich people in France and England were kicking peasants off their land, because the peasants tended to be farmers, you know, subsistence farmers. So rich people were throwing peasants off their land, grabbing the land and fencing it so they could raise cattle because they wanted meat, because meat was a rich man's food and a rich woman's food. So in the French Revolution, the oppression of the people was seen as sort of seamlessly connected to the oppression of the animals. And so there was a very strong anti-cattle raising component to the French Revolution. Give the land back to the people, stop oppressing the animals, stop oppressing the people. And you find the same connection in ancient India, by the way. Because the same movements like Buddhism, Jainism, and again, Vedic movements as well, that were, let's say, against an oppressive version of the caste system, also opposed this wanton destruction of animal life for meat consumption. So it's very interesting to see that connection as well. So in any case, as far as secularism, modernism, there really are no anti-modern, there's no anti-modern discourse in the Vedas. The Vedas really give us certain principles, like nonviolence, for example, or compassion, or spiritual principles, that human life is meant for enlightenment, and so on. And there's, I mean, the very word India, of course, you know where the word India comes from, right? You went over that?
Yes.
Okay. Sindhu, Sanskrit word Sindhu, pronounced Hindu, west of the Sindhu River by the Persians, and then the next door down is Greeks who don't pronounce an H, so Hindu becomes Hindu, or India. So it's very interesting, this Ramdev, I can't help saying this, not against Ramdev, he's probably a very nice guy, and I'm sure I'd like him if I met him. But it's very interesting that he says that you are Indian, the Indian spirit. The very word Indian is not Indian. The very word Indian is a foreign import. It's a Greek pronunciation of a Persian mispronunciation of a Sanskrit word. Anyway. So, we'll take a break, and I don't think God knows what I'll do in the next hour. So, we'll take a break now for...
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay.
Unless you need more.
No. Oh, unless I need more. We can negotiate.